jokes that people have about someone, people, is that you're all related. And sometimes it's kind of true, actually. I met PK on Facebook. Obviously, his last name was the same as mine. We share the same last name. I met him actually through Joseph Saia, who found PK when PK represented Samoan clergy at Standing Rock. And so Joseph found him there, started reading some of the writings that he is is doing as part of his PhD work. So I went to his Facebook page and saw that we share family. And we found out that my grandfather and his great-grandfather are brothers. So we're kind of third or fourth cousins. But it's been such an honor and a privilege to know him. We flew him in from Boston, where he's studying right now. He came in for the weekend to do a couple things in our community. Friday night, he was a part of a group of pastors that was having a conversation with the LGBTQ community of Pacific Islanders. So he was a part of that conversation, as was I and a few other pastors in Tacoma. Then yesterday, he was our keynote speaker at a Pacific Islander student conference that we do every year, about 400 PI students, and he was our keynote speaker. And so since he's in town, I asked him if he would be willing to share this morning with us. So you can read his bio, but would you please give him just a very warm welcome from Lake Burien, PK Thompson.
So, good morning, everyone. Let me tell you how true that stigma is with Samoan or Polynesian and Pacific people being related. When I first met my wife, some of the first questions that we asked each other, where are you from? And she told me the village she was from. She was from exactly the same village where my mother is from. So obviously we were in a frantic, because we had been dating already for at least about 2 months. Nothing happened, all right? We were just going to the movies and, you know, having dinner and things like that. But we really went deep into our lineage to find out if we were actually related. And luckily it wasn't true in that case. But my dearest, I don't even know what to call Lena if she's a fourth cousin, third cousin? My beautiful third cousin here. This is my first time here in Washington, and it's great to be greeted by family, and now to be in the presence of the rest of you, who I also consider my family in Christ. So, what will I be speaking about this morning? Maybe a quick word on the work that I do in the communities that I work for. I am a Samoan clergy. I am a social justice activist. And at the moment, I'm a student. I sit in the classroom for maybe, 3 to 4 hours a day and just continue to read and read and read. Sometimes, unwillingly, but I have to get coursework done and things like that. So that's what I do. But the things that I read about have really sort of motivated and compelled a very different side of me that was not always there. I grew up in Los Angeles during a very divided and segregated time of the 80s and the 90s as far as the Los Angeles area. And I was part of a culture that accepted me. Unfortunately, this was a culture that was very violent, gang-infested neighborhoods of South Central Los Angeles in the 80s and 90s. And our biggest enemy and our biggest fear were police officers growing up during those times. There were certain times where myself and my fellow Mexican brothers and also my black brothers and sisters, we had certain routes where we would have to take to avoid police officers. This was a reality that I had lived with in my early stages of life. I never made connections. And so I went into, to get out of this gang-infested neighborhoods, I served the U.S. military for 4 years, which took me overseas to Europe. And I ended up living there for almost close to 14 years, better half of my adult life. Now, huge paradigm shift from the streets of Los Angeles to a very open and progressive society that is also was still in recovery from the effects of World War II, a country, where I was living in Germany, that was also dealing with their own sort of social issues back then with immigration laws and things like that, and also the split of the country, which I was coming in 1995 into Germany, and the wall had just fallen 5 or 6 years previously. So there was a lot going on during that time for the country to come back together again. And I stayed overseas, and worked as a German civilian after I had gotten out of the U.S. military as a translator for the Corps of Engineers for the U.S. Army and the German civilian population. That job led to a State Department where I traveled around, to various places in Europe and also in Africa. And then in 2006, my mother got sick, and it brought me back home to America. This is the trajectory of my pathway to ministry. When I came back, I started to see things differently because I was exposed to a different culture. I started to see, connect my experiences with the experiences of others in a way that I had never done before. And I was almost at many times in deep despair and anguish and experienced extreme loneliness at different periods because I felt as if my childhood had been some way taken away from me. I started to see that there were other children that didn't have to avoid the police growing up in Los Angeles. I started to see that there were other children that had great futures and good lives. This made me very bitter and very, very introverted at many times. And I came home to the loving and caring arms of my mother, and not long before I went into ministry, she passed away. Things happen in your life, and you just wonder, are you going to let previous circumstances define who you are? But today, this morning, I want to speak to you about children and the innocence of children and how they view the world. The passage that we read this morning reminds us of how attentive children are and how many questions that they have just in general about life. We all have memories, but I think the ones that we most cherish are the ones from our childhood. We cherish them because we remember our innocence. We remember what it was like to have friends as a child, to love as a child, and to dream as a child. Children hold a very special place in our hearts. Russian author and writer Fyodor Dostoevsky writes, "The soul is healed by being with children." It's true. There's an innocence in children that most of us really long for. We long to be that of which we were before we began to see the world with adult eyes. In reading and reflecting on our readings this morning, I thought about the boy Samuel, who hears a voice calling and three times arises to go to Eli, however you may pronounce that, to ask what he wants. We know that it's God calling the boy. But even Eli is a little bit confused about what's going on and does not understand what is happening right away. Eventually, Eli tells the boy to speak to God. But why does God not speak to Eli himself? Why must the child relay the message? The author of 1 Samuel is conscious of the nature of truth-telling that children possess. Some see this as Samuel's call. I think about children, I think about calling, and the ways that sometimes we may easily miss our callings. Now, callings can look very, very different. Callings can be something that sits deep within you, but you never really react to. It causes tension within your consciousness. But it's not, you know, you don't really address it, you know, in a way that you feel is important to your life. Some people, in speaking of the call, most people, they don't even consider it sort of a major disruption in their lives. But instead, it comes like the calling that Samuel got. It's a quiet and slow awakening, perhaps to a life of service or an injustice that needs to be addressed. That's a calling. And like Samuel, they often tell about a period of uncertainty regarding what they are being called to do or be in life. But Samuel needed Eli to explain to him what these stirrings mean. And it often takes others in our lives to aid us in our understanding of how God continues to call us. I'm a theologian, so I study theology. And one of the things that I look at is the trajectory of the way people think about God in history. I'm taking a class right now, right? German theologian Karl Barth. There's an actual Barthian in the house, all right? So, Karl Barth had a major influence on theological education today. It was one of few during a time of extreme divisiveness in Europe, a time in Germany where it was easy to go along with the status quo, especially if the status quo meant a revival, a re-energizing of a people that had been previously defeated in war through the First World War, and a people that had or was experiencing social disparities of extreme poverty and basic shame. And then comes along Karl Barth, right? And he tells the Christian Church of Germany, You cannot subscribe to these ideologies because they will lead to a form of idolatry in which Karl Barth is seeing, right, as the Christian church continues to align itself with Nazi fascism. This very nationalistic tone of pride and of being proud to be German, something that is exploited by those who have more of a knowledge on how to use those things in ways in which to motivate people to fall behind a cause that they have no understanding of, but for love of country, for love of the German people, for love of the folk. Now, I believe, and in many ways, this was a sort of a sweet whisper in Karl Barth's ears. And maybe I might be, you know, doing some eisegetical work here into Karl Barth and what brought him to write the things that he wrote. But I feel like in different times we experience different prophets outside of our sacred texts. There are people speaking throughout history on injustice, on to destroy racial tensions, to destroy poverty, to destroy the hierarchies in our class, to destroy all of those things that do not belong to the teachings of Jesus, which unfortunately many are using this very truthful and peaceful gospel for very divisive and destructive ways. I look at people like Elie Wiesel as someone who testifies to the existential pain of belonging to a certain people who have experienced deep trauma. I look at prophets in sacred theology like Vine Deloria of Native Indigenous people who speak of God from the perspective of First Nations people. I look at other theologians, like one of my mentors, James Cone, who speaks from the black experience and sees God as black. Why? Because only a black God can liberate black people. I look at others who are in my own community, who are doing the work of trying to bring us, indigenous people of Samoa, back to this way of viewing nature and ecology as one, and offering sacrament and letting people know that Jesus also died for plants, fish, animals, and the water. These are the things where I continue to wrestle with. And I look back and I say to myself, I have extreme pity on my children, that this is the world that we may potentially leave them with or behind. But one thing we must also be conscious of is that Samuel is also the outsider in this story. Actually, it's Eli's sons who are more of the priestly line, and it is their birthright to serve in the temple. Yet they have not acted justly, and they have used their position for personal gain instead of service to the Lord. This is a recurring narrative of the Bible where God does not always choose the expected ones. You have Jacob, Joseph, Moses, David, all unlikely choices. And then I reflect on our second reading for this morning. That one I would like to read to you. Jesus said to them again in John 20, 21, 23, "Peace be with you, as the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." Twelve, 11, unexpected people come into contact with a Palestinian Jew and follow him around for about 2 to 3 years. And this is why we're here today. In reflecting on this commissioning of these 11 or 12 people, I think about the different life experiences that they had. Jesus calls fishermen and laborers to serve as disciples instead of the priests and prophets of Jerusalem. This tells me that power and position in the church or the community do not guarantee a similar place in God's world. All, even the outsiders, are given tasks in God's kingdom. And what does that mean for us today? The title of this talk this morning is Radical Love. This radical love. Children demonstrate a very unique form of radical love. You can hurt a child and they can be offended, right? Just like that, they forgive you. Doesn't take them long. There's not a period of them soaking that up and reflecting and thinking, how am I going to forgive this person, right? It's so easy for them to forgive. Children have this way of loving you unconditionally. I've seen cases in where I've worked with certain children who have been abused by their parents, people that they love, but still demonstrate genuine love for that person, although deep down inside, hurt by those people. Children are your best friends. You can tell them anything. They may not be the best ones in keeping secrets for you, but you know they're always there to listen and love you and be a great friend to you and loan you things and give you things. You know, I think in today's world, what's demanded of us is a very special and unique radical love. What does that mean? For different people, it means different things. In context, it means different things. In the black community, it means addressing social disparities and systemic racism and injustices. In the Latino community, it means addressing their brothers and sisters who are considered not legal. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to wrap my mind around this notion of not legal in this country because of the way it was founded, its inception. I come from the South Pacific, and most of our islands are illegally occupied as we speak. The state of Hawaii is illegally occupied as we speak. The U.S. territory of American Samoa is illegally occupied as we speak. These things of legal and not legal cause tensions and problems, and these are the issues that some of the Latinx community is dealing with. In the interreligious communities, of which I come from in New York, you have dialogue happening between Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus. Now, the dialogue is happening because there's a specific group of people who are being targeted because they choose to worship in different ways. This is in direct tension with the gospel of Jesus Christ. to also just be good stewards, be good neighbors, and be good friends. I am one of those who also is very much struggling with my Christian identity because I am also an indigenous Samoan. I also come from an island whereby my people were told that the ways that their ancestors and forebears worshipped were evil. They were spells of magic and impure. All of these things I hold in tension because the experience that I have with them is very much my experience. And I think to really be able to embody this notion of radical love, it's important that we bridge our experiences. How do we experience each other in daily lives? My community is one of those who I am working on right now to also see their experiences in their neighbors. Other communities may do that in different ways. But I challenge all of us this morning to embody this notion of radical love as children, to not see color, to not see, you know, all of these things that would keep us from going over and helping the neighbor or lending a voice to certain movements. I challenge us this morning to love more in very radical ways, however that may look for many different people. I know in my life, it looks like activism. It looks like talking, being here with you today, even though I have to tell you, I haven't slept since Friday morning. If it's one thing with Samoan communities, when they ask you to come and do something, they make sure your schedule is lined up all the way across. So I've been jumping from here to here to here to here, and I love it, and I love them, but they're both here right now, you know. And so I think it's important that they hear that. But I love them. Being here with you this morning has been a blessing. I thank you so much for inviting me into your space. It's great to sit back and look at sort of the diversity of this community. This is something that's... I live in New York City, or now in Boston. But in both spaces, I would go to a church and I'd just see white people, right? And other church spaces I go and I just see black folk. The other ones, I just see the Latino community, which is great. But once in a while, right, it's great to also see it mixed up a little bit, you know, to see and come to a space like this, in a religious space like this, and just see not only in ethnicity, but also in age groups. Because I feel like in today's world, in contemporary church spaces and things like that, you have a certain younger group navigating their way in Christian life in this sort of, setting. And then you have this older group here, and then you have everyone else in the middle, you know, just doing their own thing. So it's great to see this variety of distinct experiences here, and I can imagine how fruitful that is as a community to share your experiences both with culturally and also just your experiences in life. And for this morning, I praise God, I praise Jesus for bringing me here to fellowship with you. And I hope that in some way that today's message through me, as I am being used by the Spirit to speak to you in any way that I can in witnessing to you about my own experiences in my life, that we continue to embody a sort of radical love and continue to love each other radically. And also once in a while, go back to that very innocent time in our lives when we make so important decisions in life on whether or not to do this or to do that. So with that being said, blessings upon you. Blessings. Thank you.